Morning, everyone. Everyone awake and ready? Good. Please join me in prayer. Oh, Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, beloved Jesus Christ, Blessed Master, dearest Mother, saints and sages of all religions, I bow to all of you. Free my life from all obstacles. And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make my mind thy temple. Make my heart thy altar. Make my love thy home. Be thou the only King. Reigning on the throne of my consciousness. This morning. It's beautiful weather. Reading from Papa Ram Dass from the book The Divine Life, entitled Japa. God realization is only for him who has so controlled his mind as to subdue the desires relating to the objects of the senses. It is rightly said that a king can extend his empire to the ends of the earth. Nay, he can gain even the lordship of the worlds, but it is extremely hard to conquer and subdue the mind. The real and greater hero is he or she who has controlled and mastered the mind. The mastery is possible only when the invincible divine energy latent in the heart of the human being is awakened and set to work in place of the weak individual will and initiative. The divine name, in reaching this ideal, proves an invaluable and invincible means. Constant japa, or utterance of the name, arrests the restless nature of the mind, and developing a high state of concentration, conserves all the physical and mental energies for removing the veil of the indwelling truth, who is infinite power, light, peace, and joy. In a word, the name is an unfailing key that unlocks the gates of the heart, permitting the outflow of immortal love, wisdom, and power. Therefore, the soul is merged in the universal effulgence of an eternal and all-blissful existence. So God's all-powerful name takes the aspiring soul to the highest summit of truth. What is required first is an absolute faith in the greatness and potency of the name, which comes only by the grace of the Lord. When the name becomes the sole mainstay and refuge of the aspirant who thirsts for the highest goal of life, God realization, he or she marches toward the goal not only with rapid strides, but also with a heart filled with courage and cheerfulness. Indeed, blessed is the soul who possesses an unflinching faith in the greatness of the divine name. When we are repeating the name, we must also be having the consciousness that we are repeating the name of one who is within us, who is our true life and being. Without it, the repetition becomes merely mechanical and does not help us in any way. When we are repeating the name, we must also be having the consciousness that we are repeating the name of one who is within us, who is our true life and being. Without it, the repetition becomes merely mechanical and does not help us in any way. When we tune ourselves with the name, we tune ourselves with God. We must keep this central fact in our mind when doing the japa. Then the practice will gradually make us aware of divine existence within us. At the beginning, we are not aware of this, but we intellectually accept the idea that God dwells within us, and we are taking His name. The association with Him is there mentally, and it grows into an experience when we actually feel His presence by constantly stressing on the mind the truth that God, whom we aspire to see, is within us, and the name we repeat is His name. As we become aware of Him within us, we become conscious of Him also without us. We feel His presence everywhere. Of course, Papa was a great supporter of chanting of the name of God. And when I first came to see Mother Hamilton, the very first night, we chanted the Om Shri Ram. And Mother did it in the tune that she brought back with her from Anandashram so many years before. She went there first in 1957 and 58. When I met Mother in 1973, it had been many years, but she incorporated the chanting of the name of God along with Kriya Yoga and Hong Sa meditation. So these were the three mainstays of practice. And this name, when I first heard the tune, I was a little disturbed by it. I wasn't sure if I was attracted to it or not. But somehow, the power of it got embedded into my mind, and I took to the chanting of it when I was doing other things, when I was driving, when I was doing all sorts of things. I could be chanting the name of God. It didn't require me to close my eyes or to concentrate in any particular way other than to hear the sound of the name. I wasn't one who spoke a lot of words in those days, not like today, when I tend to be much more vocal. And so my voice would quickly get tired out. But as a result of that, I would interiorize the chanting, and I took it within. And I would be chanting it mentally. And even then, as chanting it mentally, I would feel the power of the name. I would feel the power of that vibration. When you chant it out loud, you can feel the name being chanted right within your own body. It awakens something in your heart, in your soul. You feel it vibrating inside of you. When you feel that vibration, you continue with the chanting and it purifies you. It purifies you in body, mind, and soul. And as a result of that, you begin to get lifted up into consciousness. You feel a peace at first, and then a blissful awareness begins to pervade you. In those early days, I took to driving truck. I was driving initially for my father, and then I was driving for long distance, a big semi-truck. And as I was going down the road, and there wasn't anything particularly engaging my mind, I would chant the name of Om Shri Ram. And so I crisscrossed the country, chanting the name back and forth, back and forth. And I felt the joy. I felt the bliss. I felt the peace. Before, my mind had been focused on the things of the world. Would I get to my destination on time? When would I get there? Would everything be all right? And so my mind was accustomed to all sorts of worries and anxieties about this world and my participation in it. But with the chanting of God's name, I felt a kind of peace steal over me. I felt a joy that lifted me up into divine consciousness, and this is something that I could carry on all the time. It got to the point where when I was doing the japa, when I was repeating the name of God, my eyes would begin to roll up and toward the third eye point, and I couldn't help it. It would just go up there. Well, this, of course, is not exactly a safe way to drive down the road in a big truck. So if it just insisted on doing this, I'd have to pull over for a time, allow the bliss to lift me up into that consciousness, roll my eyes up, remain absorbed deeply within, and then gradually the power of that experience would subside and I'd be able to put the truck in gear and carry on. But this is a wonderful, beautiful way to be able to have this time. There's so much time that we have in this world that ordinarily does not require 100% of our attention. We can chant the name of God. We can bring it close to us. Now also, when I drove truck, I was practicing Kriya. So I would crawl into the sleeper of the truck and I would do my Maha Mudra and the Kriya proper and the Yoti Mudra. And I would do that all sitting into the back of the truck. And sometimes it was a little cramped there, but I could do it. And so these things are practices that begin to really take effect over time. We begin to feel the transformative power. One day, when I was living in Bellingham, and by that time I was going to university, and I joined in with a group of people, and we were all meditating together. And during that meditation session, I felt at the base of my spine a sudden, it felt like a snap, something breaking almost. And this tremendously powerful stream of energy went from the base of my spine all the way to my ajna, that third eye point between the eyebrows where I had been concentrating. And my attention was totally riveted. It couldn't be anything else but riveted to that spot between the eyebrows. It was like a huge gravitational force pulling everything into it. And I was completely focused, and it became so hot. And the idea came to me, I think I could fry eggs on my forehead. It feels so hot there. And this lasted for some time, perhaps 10 minutes or so. And then the experience began to gradually subside, and the intensity of the heat began to go down, and my attention there was able to be a little less fixed. And this started me on a new journey, a journey of the Kundalini, the journey of this divine Shakti consciousness, this divine power within us that is transformative. Now, for some people, this Shakti power gradually unloosens itself and rises up through the spine and takes us through many experiences. And we don't have such radical shifts. For others, there is this more radical shift of the kind that I experienced. And it's powerful. And it is transformative. And it does take you on a journey. Now, the interior process begins to guide you, and you begin to surrender yourself to what this divine consciousness will do in and around you. But it's not the end of the journey by any stretch of the imagination. It's really just the beginning. And you feel the awakening within your spine. You feel a tingling sensation there. You feel a power that is flowing within your spine and your brain. You see, we are all created with this capacity to go within the spine and the brain. It is the spiritual evolution. It's the next stage. The stage previously we entered into is becoming human. We move from what can be called lower life forms into the higher life form of being human. Why higher? It is because there is a unique capacity within this human being of having the sixth and seventh chakra opened and become fully illumined. It does happen on very rare occasions that lower life forms can experience such awakenings, but generally it is the province of a human being to enter into that highest divine consciousness. And so there is an awakening within the human being when we evolve into that human state, that there's a higher intelligence. Suddenly we can think abstractly. We can begin to focus our attention on future tense, not just present tense. We can also revisit the past. Now this is a two-edged sword, because in the same way that we can now have greater capacity of mind for stretching into the future and reaching back into the past, we can also be plagued with it. We can become preoccupied. What's going to happen to me? That was my current state when I started doing the name, is that so much of my attention was out there. The center of gravity for me was what other people thought, what situations would bring to me. And I felt that I was always in a responsive situation, a reactive situation to what others were doing. I was extremely sensitive to what other people might think, might say, might do. I was less conscious, less aware of the divine consciousness that centered right inside of me. And one of the great changes that can come over us is that our awareness that God is flowing to me, as we talked about yesterday in our prosperity class, that God is flowing to you from behind you, through the spine, into you, through your body, and then out from you into this world. Now, as you attune yourself to this flow of prana, of divine consciousness, you can experience a great transformation that begins to really center your world right inside of you. If you, like I, in the past, have given more power to those around you than to yourself and your participation in this world, then you are denying God within you. And this is a great problem. When we are more preoccupied with our anxiety and all the ways that we are feeling powerless, perhaps, not good enough, all of those kinds of old conditionings that are in us, we are not really worshiping God. When you think of that God comes first, you put God first, you worship God first, that means you put your mind on God. That means that whether it's through the action of repeating God's name, whether it's through Kriya Yoga, whether it's through meditation, whether it's feeling and practicing the divine presence within you, and feeling it go out from you, you are putting God first when you put your attention there. When your attention is drawn outside of you, and now the events of the world seem larger than you, now what other people think or do or say is larger than what you think, do or say. You have put these graven images from the world on the altar, and you are essentially worshiping graven images and not the indwelling spirit of God first. So putting the presence of God within you. Now, how is this different than the ego? The ego feels, I am this, I do this, I say this. When the ego is put into its proper position, it becomes the witness. It is no longer the actor and does not feel that it is doing the works. It is my Father in heaven who doeth the works. That means that you stand aside and you are a witness to what the divine consciousness is doing in you, through you, and all around you. You are now a humble, obedient servant. Ram Dass means the servant of God or the slave of God. There's a fun story. It wasn't fun to everybody, but it was with Swami Ramatirtha. And his father sent him off to a guru. Now, for many people, in traditional Indian society, the guru was an educator, someone who taught you your reading, your writing, your reasoning skills, your math skills, generally all-around education, and also taught you about what it was to be a spiritual person and how to carry on in your life as a spiritual person. And that was your early education. Now, traditionally, you are in that stage, the Brahmachari stage, from early age until you are about 25. And at the age of 25, you're considered ready to go out into the world and make your way in the world, usually in the traditional society, to take over your father's business. It traveled down through family lineages in this way. And so Swami Ramatirtha's father, before he became Swami Ramatirtha, he wrote to his guru and he says, it's time to send my son back. I'm ready for him to step into my business shoes and take over the business here. And I'm ready to retire. Swami Ramatirtha wrote back to his father and said that I'm not coming back. The father was not happy about this. Swami Ramatirtha had been inspired to lead a spiritual life fully dedicated, not going back into the family business, not taking on a family. It was considered more rare in traditional days for somebody to become a renunciant early in life. Usually that was reserved for the time of life when you had raised your children and you had entered into retirement. And oftentimes people took vows of renunciation at that time. But Swami Ramatirtha felt such an incredible pull toward that life. And so his father wrote back to his guru, and he was very angry about this. This is not at all what he was thinking his son was being sent there for. And Swami Ramatirtha again wrote back to his father, and he said, "Your son has been sold as a slave to God." And he felt this way because he felt that every particle of his being was being surrendered to that divine consciousness, and that he could not carry on in the old worldly way as he once had. And so the father, of course, was not happy about this, but eventually became reconciled to it. Swami Satchidananda said, in India, everybody likes the idea of there being swamis and spiritual aspirants as long as they're somebody else's son, not their own son, because they want their own son back in the family, carrying on the family business and supporting the elders as they grow into their retirement ages. And so it's difficult to accept. My own parents knew that I was taking on a new life, a different kind of life. But they had a very studious way of avoiding the subject in any kind of possible way. And when I entered into the path, it was with a little consternation on their part, but nothing major. And then they accepted that my sister-in-law took Kriya initiation from mother, and my brother took Kriya initiation from me. But then when my nephew took Kriya initiation, well, this was just a little bit too much. So they finally said, "We don't know about these things, but we want you to talk to our minister." It's a Methodist minister. So I went and met with Brad, who is a wonderful minister for the Methodist Church. And we were talking, I was talking about this path and what it was and our perspective of things. And he said, "I've been feeling an emptiness in my spiritual life. And I feel like what you're talking about is the answer to my prayer. This is what I've been looking for to make it fuller and more complete." And I was astounded, and this is a wonderful development, of course. And when I returned to my parents, my father said, "Well, did you convert him or did he convert you?" And because it's a small town and people can get in trouble, I didn't repeat what the minister had said. I just said, "Well, I liked him very much and he liked me very much." He gave a stamp of approval, the minister did, Brad did, and that made it all right with them. They didn't understand it. They had no inkling to understand it, but they were all right with it. It wasn't something dangerous or bad or evil, according to their minister, so that it was all right. Each and every one of us are called to a spiritual life, and we are called in our own way. We come in our own time. This grace that Papa talks about that takes us over, it's a mysterious thing. How somebody can practice for many, many years and be diligent about their practice, and somehow that inner awakening does not come. It seems a void to them. It seems empty somehow. They've not caught the spirit. When Papa took to the life of a sannyas and he was traveling around, he was filled with the bliss of God. In fact, before he left, when he was still in the family home, he was absolutely surcharged with this divine bliss and consciousness. And it was through the inspiration of this inner divine consciousness that he felt absolutely compelled to go out into a renunciant's life. And as he traveled around from place to place, he met many, many sadhus, the wandering monks who would go from place to place, staying no longer than 3 days in any particular place, begging their food as they went, doing some form of spiritual practice or another. And they would ask Papa because they would see the difference. They would see the radiance on his face. They would see him lit up from inside. "How long have you been practicing? How long have you been a sadhu?" And when he informed them of less than a year, they were astounded. "I've been doing this for 20 years, 25 years, and clearly I am not experiencing what you are experiencing. I don't have that bliss. I don't have that light. I don't have that joy that you exhibit throughout your entire being. I see the light of God on your face. How can this be?" And Papa would think to himself, "How could this be?" These different sadhus, apparently, practicing with all of their heart and soul, doing everything they could to bring themselves into that state, and yet they're coming up empty. Nothing doing. And so Jesus said, you cannot predict when this will come. It is like the wind. Suddenly it'll pick up one day, and it'll begin to blow, and you don't know from what direction. You don't know when, you don't know how hard it will blow. But there it is. That is what grace is like. And so we prepare ourselves. We learn to steady the mind. It becomes steady like a flame burning on a candle that is protected from the wind. It's just steady. Now, if you take away that protection, the flame flickers this way and that, and sometimes it could get snuffed completely out. And so if you think that your practice is that protective shield, is the glass that's put around the flame. And with that protective glass, with chanting the name, with meditating deeply, that flame becomes absolutely steady. Steady. You don't think of anything else. You don't think of trying to accomplish anything else. You just think of making your mind steady, just like that flame. And when your mind becomes steady like that, an inner peace begins to dawn on you. A tranquility begins to spread over your being. Now, in the beginning, as soon as you leave your meditation blanket, that steadiness of mind begins to get influenced by the things of the world. A telephone rings. You begin to get ready for work, and you start thinking of work, and you armor yourself up. You start to protect yourself from this world. You're no longer with that steady mind. You feel like you are subject to the influences of everything that goes on in this world. As this grace and as this practice begins to grow in you, this sense of I-ness inside of you, the great I, the large I, not the little ego who's always restless, but the great divine I within you begins to grow in stature. That becomes the thing that's on your altar. You worship that first. You put God first. That presence, that feeling, that sense, that very real life within you, a divine life, begins to grow more and more. There was a time in my development where my psychic body became very sensitive to this world. I felt other people's energy. I felt their thoughts. I felt their feelings very keenly. And it was oftentimes, as you can imagine, painful to be around other people because I would pick up and feel their pain. When I was in groups of people, it was oftentimes painful for me. And I asked Mother about this. And I said, you know, why is it that this is the way that it is? And she said, this is the way of growth. This is the way it is. First, you feel God within you. And then gradually, you begin to see Him everywhere about you. But I had not yet come to that point where I could see God around me as keenly as I could experience Him within me. But over time, the strength of that knowledge, the strength of that experience of having God within me, grew more to where it began to pour out through my eyes. It began to radiate out through my feeling of touch. It began to influence all the senses, and instead of being like a sponge that soaked up what everybody else had, I still had sensitivity in that way of intuition. But now what was more keenly felt within me was the strength, the power, the peace, the joy, the bliss, the light of the divine presence within me. And as that grew in power, I was less and less influenced by those things that were around me and those people that were around me. And so this is all a process. You must be willing to be in it for the long haul. I compare it that you cannot be a sprinter, you must be a long-distance runner. And you look at these runners as they're running, say, a marathon or a long distance. They're actually running quite hard. It's not that they're stopping and smelling the flowers along the way and doing all kinds of other things. They are intent on their running, and yet they cannot be at a full-out sprint or they would completely wear themselves out. They've discovered a power that helps propel them. And they can do it with a steady, strong strides. And it is certainly not that you cannot enjoy life. We are meant to enjoy life. We can enjoy life along the way. Somebody asked me the other day, well, can't we take rests? Aren't there times of taking rests? And I said, you know, what's embedded in your question is really revealing that you're doing this from an ego standpoint. Because it's the ego that feels like it needs a rest. It's the ego that feels worn out. If you feel that this grace is operating inside of you, and that grace is lifting you up, that grace is doing the heavy work, and your part is to focus your mind on that grace, then is there ever a time when you would say you would want to break from God's presence, from that grace, from that bliss, from that joy? And of course, when put in that way, there's never a time when we want to break from that because we only want that more and more. It's only the ego that feels that this is too hard, that it's too much. And it's because the ego has gotten involved and we're not feeling that divine consciousness. Feel that grace. Feel the name. Chant the name. And allow it to lift you up. To continue with Papa, of all the disciplines for controlling the restless mind, there is none so easy and efficacious as the repetition of God's name. But the difficulty with some is that they cannot repeat the name continuously, although they desire to do so. The reason for this is that their love for the name is not greater than their love for the perishable objects of the world. It is a psychological truth that our mind thinks most about the object which we love most. Isn't that true? If we really love something, we can't keep our minds off of it. Because our concentrated love inevitably influences the mind to remember that object, so also if our mind is filled with an intense love for the name, this love will automatically enable us to repeat the name constantly. The name of God will start on our tongue spontaneously, and it will run on it continuously. Further, the sweet sound issuing from the utterance of the name will prove to be a veritable nectar to the attentive ear. When thus the mind is inebriated, as it were, with the love of God and filled with the music of His name, all its desires will be transmuted into divine waves of ecstasy, and all the movements of the senses will be saturated with the same joy. When we are in this joy, the vision of God will flash out of us and grant us the experience of the universal reality, God. This is the ineffable summit of divine union and revelation. And so we become so transformed, we become so purified through and through, that divine consciousness is all that there is, and we want nothing more. What is extremely difficult in talking about this is that the words are symbols of experiences, people, and objects. But you cannot really give the essence of an individual by repeating their name only. You must go to the source. You must go to the essence. You must have that experience. And if you do not have that experience, or if you have not had it profoundly in the way that you would like it, then let us pray deeply to God that we should have it. I remember once when I was praying deeply to God that I would have love for God. And it seemed a little odd to me that I'd be praying to God to have love for God. And yet, who else would give it to me? Where else would I get it from? What I wanted is I wanted more attraction to the divine consciousness than I had for the world, than I had for things, than I had for people's opinions, than I had for sex, than I had for anything at all. I had some faith deep inside of me, and it was actually a challenge that I put down to God, that He sublimate and satisfy all my desires for this world. And that if He could do that, then there would be no problem me completely giving myself over to Him, because what would I be missing? If he could be the ecstasy that I felt in meeting certain people, getting a certain job, having a certain amount of money, having exactly the kind of situation that I wanted, if he could be as pleasurable as food, as sex, as anything that I would have through this body, then what am I giving up exactly? What am I renouncing? I'm getting everything. Only it's continuous and being given to me without any measure, without any respite. The yogis have compared divine ecstasy, samadhi, as having 10,000 orgasms simultaneously. That's quite something. And when you feel the sweetness of that, when you feel the fullness of it, when you feel the love of that, when you feel the complete merging of yourself into that divine ecstasy, and that it's not here just for a minute and then gone, it's not something that can be taken away from you, then what in the world do we think we're renouncing? We may be letting go of a few baubles, a few promises that this world is so ready to make but so slow on fulfilling any of its promises for happiness, and certainly cannot promise permanent and lasting happiness. Only God can do that. So let us love God more than this world. Seek ye first the kingdom of heaven, and everything else is taken care of for you. Open yourself to this tremendous flow of divine consciousness coming from behind you through the spine, creating through you, through your mind, through your will, through your heart, through your spirit, and then emanating out to this world as a glow of light and love, of peace and joy. And you will be fulfilling a tremendous dream that God has had for you, that you would manifest those qualities that are of divine nature on this world. And doesn't this world need it desperately? And it needs examples of those who are willing to lead the life and then manifest those divine virtues in all that they say, think, and do. So let us fulfill Papa's dream here, all the great master's dreams. They know what we may be. They know that already. We don't know it. That's the problem. So we dilly-dally alone. We don't really do what we know we should be doing, giving up a few baubles here and there, that we may have the divine ecstasy that will be with us always. Cute story that Bob Raymer told me. He was a minister. Master made him a minister. And before he would give a talk, when Master asked him to be a minister, Bob Raymer said, "Master, I haven't been with you, you know. How am I supposed to give talks?" And he says, "Don't worry." He says, "You focus on me. Everything will be well." So Bob Raymer, every time he would give a talk, he'd always send a telegram to Master and say, "I'm giving a talk on Sunday at 11 o'clock. You be focused on me. You be praying for me. So that's the only way I'm going to be able to do anything good here." So he always did that until Master's passing. And then Master left the body. He goes, "Well, what do I do now? Who do I send the telegram to?" So he would sit and he would pray. And he would wait until he felt Master's presence in the room. And then as a result of that, then he felt all right. "Now I have the go-ahead. I have the go-ahead." So I've always remembered that. And as we sat here beforehand, I turned my focus of attention upon Master, upon Mother, and upon Papa. And upon Sri Aurobindo, two nights ago, I had a tremendous experience sitting upstairs with Sri Aurobindo. I've never had any connection with him in the past. I've known about him, known some about his life. And he's actually a cousin of Yogananda's. But I had never had any feeling of connection with him. And suddenly, I felt myself to be in his room as he sat in his chair. And we had a few hours of sitting with each other. And there's many things that passed between us. And it was a wonderful, wonderful time. And when you have these interior experiences, you know the difference between imagination and the reality of a divine connection in this way. And so I also felt the presence this morning of Sri Aurobindo, as well as Master and Mother and Papa. And I feel them here now. I feel this room blessed by their presence. This is a work that all the Masters have blessed. And if we can make ourselves sensitive and attuned to that divine will, those Masters ever stand ready to help us in this great work of transformation. And if you will just put forward the effort, the time and the effort, we have time and effort for so many things in this world, but with God it just always seems like, well, I'm a little too tired. I just have all these other things to do, Lord. I can't do it today. And so we put it off and off and off. But if we can put God first, really, put that first, and develop a love affair for that divine presence and consciousness, it will be no effort at all. We will run to the meditation room because we will so much want to have that time of communion and bliss and peace that deepens through that inner communion of meditation. And if you don't have that love, then pray to God for that love. And He will certainly grant that prayer. Now if you will pray with me, O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, I feel the wonder and the beauty of Thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for Thee. I kneel in adoration at Thy feet and surrender myself to Thee. I feel the power of Thy perfection surging in every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence are radiant with Thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss of my communion with Thee. I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am He. Bow to the divine within you. May God and the Masters ever bless you and keep you and lift you into their divine consciousness.